I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We have our Thursday international briefing for you. We'll go to Mexico to find out what authorities are doing to try to stop an ever more violent drug war. But first, a newsmaker conversation with a woman who's trying to build peace. So many of the conflicts we cover on this and other programs are in countries where civil society has been broken because of war or other crises. We've heard about the role peacekeeping forces can play in these situations, but what does it take to build peace? Jane Hall Lute was Assistant Secretary General for Mission Support in Peacekeeping Operations at the United Nations. She's recently been placed in charge of the UN's Peace Building Commission, and she's with us now from New York. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
As you step into this position, what's your first priority?
The peacebuilding challenge in the United Nations is a new one. The member states came together in 2005 and said that they didn't feel that they were organized well enough to handle the post-conflict recovery challenges that presented themselves, whether or not a peacekeeping mission was present. And they created an architecture they call the peace-building architecture. And my job is to lead the portion of that that falls under the Secretary General, together with a fund for peacebuilding and the Peacebuilding Commission itself, to put in place a way of thinking about and undertaking effective post-conflict recovery action.
Help us understand the difference between the peacekeeping operation and the peacebuilding operation.
Peacekeeping is represented in the Blue Helmets. It's something the United Nations has been doing for over 60 years. The purpose of peacekeeping, the reason the world has peacekeepers, is to protect and strengthen fragile peace, to put together operations that consist of military personnel, police, a political component, and others, to address that very sensitive phase in the aftermath of a peace settlement where help is often necessary to stabilize the situation and permit forward progress. Peace building is really an agenda that seeks to put in place a solid foundation so that societies emerging from conflict can definitively recover from that conflict.
How is what you do different than an NGO? What tools do you have that an NGO wouldn't have?
NGOs tend to be quite agenda-specific. They're an extremely important part of the international response to crises on the ground, and they bring hardworking, dedicated, extremely knowledgeable people who work in the relatively narrowly drawn terms of reference that each NGO has, whether it's working on maternal health, victims' rights, water sanitation, or whatever area. Very often, but not always, NGOs have national partners on the ground so that they themselves might be headquartered in Geneva or London or Paris, but they have local partnerships in order, again, to create some capacity within the societies on the ground. The peacebuilding effort of the United Nations reflects the view of the membership of the United Nations, which is to say the 192 member states. So this is when these governments come together and they look at the post-conflict challenges in the Congo, in Liberia, in Guinea-Bissau, in Sierra Leone, for example. Are we doing the kinds of things that will help create definitive recovery from conflict? And so it's a much broader perspective.
You know, it's interesting because on the one hand, it sounds like a no-brainer. On the other hand, it's curious that this is a new task, a new position. Forgive me, I don't mean to be disrespectful, but it just seems intuitively obvious that if we were to have a natural disaster, first there would come rescue and recovery, and then would come rebuilding.
Right.
And it just seems curious that we're only now adopting this point of view toward international conflicts that are as, if not more, devastating than a natural disaster.
Right. No, I follow what you mean. You know, on the one hand, you know, every idea whose time has come began as an idea ahead of its time. But on the other hand, what we're really talking about is now a political statement on the part of the 192 membership of the United Nations that they have a responsibility and a role to play in helping societies recover from conflict. And this is an important step forward. These problems are as hard as they get because the conflict that these societies are emerging from was designed to make it impossible to recover. And the member states said, you know, sorry, we're not going to sit by. We're going to engage.
Tell me a little bit about yourself. We were talking earlier, and you mentioned that you're a former soldier. What attracted you to this job? I mean, on the one hand, this is the best work that could possibly be. On the other hand, I could think this is the kind of work where one would feel that you'd never succeeded.
You know, you got to wake up every day and go to bed every night and feel as though you've used the privileges that you've been given and put them to greater purpose and greater good. I feel as though working on peace building is kind of, for me, a natural, not culmination, but a natural evolution of my own personal experience. I spent the first part of my adult life as a soldier. I'm very proud of the fact that I've been a soldier. I immersed myself in the profession of being a soldier and learning how to fight and win our nation's wars. And we were deeply immersed in that approach to what it meant to be a professional soldier in the Army of the United States of America. Following that period, or actually during that time, the Army sent me to Stanford for my PhD, and I wrote about how wars end, why they end when they do. Why don't they end sooner? Why does it seem that there are impediments to war ending when they're so destructive of human life and of property and of livelihoods and of outlooks? Then I got sent to the desert in 1991 and worked exactly on those issues. Can we stop now? Have we met our military objectives? How is what's happening on the battlefield relating to the political aims and purposes of the war? After that, I had an opportunity to work a lot on various conflicts and various conflict settings, and then went to work on a project on preventing deadly conflict. It's an extraordinary experience to think about how you might prevent the outbreak, spread, or emergence of violent conflict. I mean, war is not the weather. Why do we act like it is? And so then I was a peacekeeper for 5 intense years. And now my job is to put all that to work with my colleagues and figure out how to build a durable peace.
Peacekeeping itself and the UN peacekeeping forces itself, what's the word I'm looking for? There are different views. I mean, on the one hand, we just had the opportunity to speak with the president of Liberia, Ellen Johnson
Sirleaf. She's amazing.
And she has requested that peacekeepers remain in the country for some period of time. On the other hand, there have been some terrible abuses, as we all know, by peacekeeping staff in the Congo and in other places. And I'm wondering, how do you – I mean, all humans are capable of bad behavior. I think we all can appreciate that. But how do you build upon what is best about the UN while preventing the kinds of abuses that we have seen in some places?
Is that a fair question, do you think? It's a very fair question.
The
peacekeepers deploy in the service of the most inclusive public sector institution in the world. We've been given the very special privilege of going to assist societies emerging from conflict at their most vulnerable. How can it be that those who are sent to help become agents of such heinous behavior and activities? There's no excuse for it. It doesn't matter that it happens elsewhere. It doesn't matter that anyone else does it. Peacekeepers ought to reflect the highest standards and aspirations that humanity has. That's the tradition that every new peacekeeper inherits. How do you preserve it? It's a sacred trust. There is no excusing this behavior. Not long deployments, not being far away from home, not operating in relative privation. It's a question of preventing that behavior, enforcing the standards when they're violated, and addressing the needs of victims and societies when some of our number have violated that trust. And over the past 4 or 5 years, we've undertaken a comprehensive structural program because we realize when you're going to be very large, and peacekeeping, if all the numbers and all the missions were fully deployed, would be nearly 140,000 peacekeepers, military, police, and civilians. Represents the second largest deployed expeditionary force in the world. You have to take a structural approach to the problem. So the privilege that we've been able to undertake in Liberia reflects the same privilege elsewhere. And President Johnson Sirleaf, you know, deserves the very best help the international community can bring to bear, and peacekeeping is part of that.
In the past, of course, UN peacekeeping has also come in for criticism for what's perceived as failures of mission in Rwanda, for example. In the past, has the scope and mandate of peacekeeping something that frustrates you? And do you believe that you will have sufficient mandate to do what you need to do in this job?
You know, peacekeeping is probably in its third, maybe be entering its fourth generation of existence. I mean, and each generation has been very markedly different from the one before. The first 40 years or so, peacekeeping was a sort of fixed peace, interpositional arrangement, lightly armed troops under agreed circumstances of ceasefire. There have been a few exceptions, but that's broadly been the rule. Then there was the experience of the 90s, where scholars have argued that peacekeeping was thrown at every problem that confronted the international community, irrespective of whether or not it was the right remedy for what the problem was. Coming out of that experience in which Rwanda and Somalia and others, Srebrenica, occurred, Lakhdar Brahimi, a very distinguished diplomat, convened an international group and said, look, there are some fundamental truths and principles about the best way to do peacekeeping. And one of them was that, you know, there must be a peace to keep. The member states, when they deploy a mission, must properly resource it. The mandate must be clear and achievable. You know, a peacekeeping mission can usefully accompany a political process designed to lead to lasting peace. It cannot substitute for that process. And those lessons have been trying to incorporate since 2000, when that report was written. We're entering a new phase, a new generation, complex missions. Peace does not exist on the ground in all cases. How should we adapt?
As you start this job, how will you know whether you have succeeded?
What a great question. You know, it was always true to me as a peacekeeper, and I think it will be true to me now in this job, is that your success is really never measured in what you're able to do, but what people and leaders are able to do on their own behalf. Have we helped create the space and the support for the emergence of a capable society, one that has representative governance, the kind of economic activity that offers opportunity for the widest number, a stable civil society based on the rule of law? Have we done what we can to help create those conditions in those circumstances? Then the success would certainly not be mine or the UN's, but it would be theirs. But we would know that we had a role to play.
Jane Hall Lute has recently been appointed the head of the United Nations Peace Building Commission. She was kind enough to join us from the studios at the United Nations. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.